Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, October 24, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing national security leaks. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us J. Patrick Rowan, partner at McGuire Woods, Professor Mark S. Zaid, adjunct faculty at Johns Hopkins University, and our moderator, Adam Perlman, special advisor to the International and National Security Law Practice Group. I will turn it over to Adam to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Adam. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura, and thank you, everybody, for calling in. Let's just get started right off the bat. You know, if ever it was not, there can be little doubt that information is presently the world's most valuable commodity. We store it, we hoard it, we trade it. From the perspective of governance, looking back to the earliest days of Washingtonian espionage during our Revolutionary War, to the modern techniques of collection and analysis, intelligence acquired has guided some of our nation's most important policy decisions, just as its protection is among our greatest concerns. The same is true in the commercial sector. But this teleform today focuses specifically on leaks of national security information. As our listeners today are no doubt aware, leaks of classified or politically sensitive information have become part of the daily news cycle. With them, Assange, Snowden, and Manning have become household names. Some believe leakers to be patriots, others consider them traitors. That morally charged debate which has dominated the dialogue about leaks is not today's conversation. Instead, over the next hour, our two experts are going to discuss motivations, countermeasures, and consequences. That is to say, why leakers leak, the tedious procedures and mechanics of investigating leakers, and what the government considers when deciding how to appropriately respond once the leaker is identified. My name is Adam Perlman, and it's my privilege today to be joined by J. Patrick Rowan and Mark Zaid. Patrick Rowan was the first Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the National Security Division of the United States Department of Justice and its second Assistant Attorney General. At NSD, he managed DOJ's national security investigations and prosecutions, oversaw all espionage investigations, and supervised the government's practice before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and the oversight of intelligence collection activities. Before that, he served as an assistant United States attorney for more than a decade, prosecuting more than 60 jury trials. As Laura mentioned, he's currently a partner at McGuire Woods. Now, Mark Zaid's law practice specializes in matters relating to national security, intelligence, sovereign and diplomatic immunity, and, of course, FOIA. He's also the founder and the longtime executive director of the James Madison Project, which strives to educate the public on issues relating to intelligence gathering and operations, secrecy policies, national security, and government wrongdoing. In that vein, he also recently co-founded Whistleblower Aid, a nonprofit law firm that promotes lawful reporting of government misconduct without illegally releasing classified information. I'm going to kick things off with a quote that stuck with me since I first read it several years ago. The late Lee Kuan Yew, former Prime Minister of Singapore, once opined that, and I quote, "Because American officials release secrets, that is supposed to be the in thing. It shows that yours," and he meant ours, "is a free society where if any ministers or courts suppress the truth, you feel it is your duty to leak it to the opposition. That is something new, and it is not proven. So when you tamper around with the fundamentals of society, the effects are in the next, and often after the next generation." Now, Lee said that in 1984, 33 years ago. In July of this year, a majority staff report of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs described daily leaks of national security information since President Trump took office. Shortly thereafter, CIA Director Mike Pompeo cited what he called leaker worship as a factor in the increase of leaks. So, Mark, we'll start with you. You've represented persons accused of leaking classified information. What's going on here? And did Lee Kuan Yew kind of have a Nostradamus moment and predict all this?
Thanks, Adam. It's a pleasure to be here. I wouldn't say that he predicted it. I would say that he described something that is a factor, particularly here in Washington, although not all these leaks were in Washington geographically, something that is recognized. And, you know, we have basically an attention span here in probably, I'd say, even modern America, maybe about 15 or so years. And so a lot of these issues with respect to leaks, they've been around far longer than probably all of us that have been on, they're on this telephone call right now. In fact, one particular commission, which was called the Wright Commission, W-R-I-G-H-T, was a member of Congress back in the 50s. This commission report came out in about 1957, as I recall, and it's amazing. It's about, I'm looking at it now, it's got to be about 2.5 inches thick or so. And if you read it now and you just changed the cover and the date to reflect 2017 instead of 1957, basically all the issues that plagued the government and American society in the national security realm back then are still in existence today. So what has changed, and we'll get into this a little bit more, I know, in the conversation in a little bit, what has changed really is not the fact that these leaks are occurring, but it's the process by which they occur. It's the tools that are used to allow them to occur. It's basically an impact of technology and an ease of gaining access to classified information that didn't exist before, which in turn has also made it more easy for the government to identify leakers too.
So is there, have you noted a difference in motivations of individuals, or is it really just the technical means that lend themselves to an easier and broader dispersal of sensitive information?
Well, motivation definitely comes into play. Again, I wouldn't say there's something new about it other than, as is often the case, it's very generational. So there is a view, as we look at some of the more prominent leakers in the last few years who all tend to be millennials, and there is a different generational view that exists within the millennials than, say, myself, who I think is a Generation Xer. But if you look then at perhaps what existed back in the days of Daniel Ellsberg in the late 60s, early 70s with the Vietnam generation, the baby boomers for the most part, and maybe a tiny bit before that as well. You know, I think from a societal standpoint, we're probably seeing a little bit more of a generation that is sort of radicalized. I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm just saying really motivated on a political level that we haven't seen, say, in the last 25 years that I've been here in D.C. Didn't see that during the Clinton, Bush, maybe a little bit in the Obama administration, as I think it's really more about the community and society becoming more polarized. And that polarization from a political standpoint, ideologically, does impact how some of these classified leak occurs if it's not a true Espionage Act case like Pat might have been handling when he was at the Justice Department.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good transition to, you know, Pat, as Assistant Attorney General, I'm sure that you receive several calls in the middle of the night waking you up with various things. But let's say, for example, you wake up in the morning and you pick up New York Times, Washington Post, or log on to Drudge, whatever it was you were going to do, and it's clear that there's a leak. To the extent that you can, you know, describe what comes next.
I'd be happy to do that. I want to also thank you for having me today, Adam. I'm looking forward to this discussion. So there is, as you can imagine, a rather well-organized process within the government to pursue leak investigations. And there are certainly instances where the leak investigation kicks off because somebody at a very high level opens the paper and says, this is terrible, and that person, whether it's, you know, the DNI or the president, calls the attorney general and says, what are we going to do about this? even in those instances, there's still a process that really kicks in and informs how an investigation will occur. At its core, there are a set of questions that the owner of the classified information is expected to answer, and those answers are provided to the FBI and the DOJ, and those answers are what generally drive the initial determination whether or not this is something that's ought to be pursued as a leak case, as a leak investigation that hopefully leads to a prosecution. And they're known as the 11 questions. I believe they're still just 11. And at their core, what they're intended to do is try to get the agency who owns the classified information that was disclosed to get them to provide information about exactly what is it that was classified that's in that newspaper article, for example. So there's often a general, you know, sense of, gosh, that seems like very sensitive stuff that's in that article, but they're required to go through and actually isolate the sentence or two sentences or paragraph that is classified information. And when they're talking about classified information, they're talking about, you know, that agency is going to be in a position to stand behind the assertion that this is the magic words of the statute are national defense information, but for our purposes, that this is classified information, that this is information that the disclosure of which could potentially harm, you know, the U.S. government's national security interests. And they're also expected to explain what was the official dissemination of that information before it was disclosed, and what are the potential short-term and long-term impacts of the unauthorized disclosure. So all this information is supposed to be provided to the FBI and the DOJ by the agency that owns it. And, you know, that's the information that is used to really figure out, is this a case worth pursuing? Because if the agency involved has a hard time articulating exactly what it is that's classified that's in that article, or the numbers of individuals who are aware of this secret before it became public are huge, that would reduce the appetite of DOJ and FBI to investigate the matter. So that's really the first step, is trying to figure out, you know, is this something that we can do anything about? And I should make it clear, I'm not really talking about the Snowden or Manning type cases where there's a huge dump. We're talking about like a secret that gets disclosed and is at the core of an article in the newspaper or on the media of some other kind. And so because remember, the challenge of this investigation is generally going to be to figure out who leaked the information. That's the first problem. It's often very difficult to identify the leaker because, as we can talk about, the DOJ and the FBI do not go to the person who wrote that article. They're not going to go to the reporter. They're going to try to investigate it by other means. In addition, there's a question about, you know, if you were to be able to identify that person, could a leak prosecution go forward? For a lot of reasons, there's some challenges there. But the first thing is, okay, you know, how widely disseminated was this information? How sensitive is it? How damaging is it going to be? And from there, the DOJ and the FBI sort of pursue an investigative strategy. And that strategy really doesn't change depending upon how high profile the leak is or how high profile the person complaining about the leak is. There's a process that gets followed in nearly all these cases.
Now, it sounds like the review involves almost a contemporaneous, I guess what might be an equivalent of a declassification review of the information. You're not just relying on the how the information was originally classified, but doing a damage assessment at the time of the leak. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's all what really I think happens in these cases is the agency is expected to answer those questions up front, but then there's another kind of more searching and probing discussion of those issues if and when the government gets farther along in its case and it's really thinking, hey, we may have a prosecution here. Because it's often the case that an agency will, the director of the agency, whether it's the CIA or NSA or some other part of the intelligence community, when that secret shows up in the New York Times, they have their hair on fire about it. It's very upsetting, and it becomes, you know, it's a big deal at the time. And so, you know, they may well initially say, we'll support a prosecution. This is terrible, et cetera. And then, you know, a year and a half later, with water under the bridge and other things going on, in a sort of more sober analysis, they may say, you know what, we're concerned about a prosecution here because we're worried about the other secrets that may come out of it. This really wasn't all that damaging, as it turns out. So they have another bite at the apple, but that is an issue that you want to look at the very beginning, and it's an issue that can, you know, derail an investigation at any time.
Right. So from the government's perspective, what would distinguish your lawful whistleblower from a leaker, you know, a criminal leak activity?
Well, there are, and Mark's really the expert on this. There are statutes on the books that are intended to permit whistleblowers to blow the whistle on some government secret. I understand they have their flaws, but they're there, and including for potentially classified information to be disclosed up through, you know, the inspector general of an agency and all that. So, from the prosecutor's perspective, if it's a lawful whistleblower, there's a set of it shouldn't have it. Well, if it's a lawful whistleblower, it shouldn't have appeared in the New York Times or the Washington Post in general. I think, the hard part is, and the hardest thing I think is if you were to have a case where an individual appears to have, you know, followed all the internal procedures for whistleblowing, but got nowhere. And perhaps even gotten nowhere because the agency didn't take it seriously the way they ought to have, and then they leak it. That's still going to be an illegal leak, but it certainly changes, I think, the way the prosecutors ought to look at it. And there's been some instances in the past where things like that happened, and I think hopefully the government has learned about the challenges of those kinds of cases. I mean, I'd be interested in Mark, if you disagree that the fact that it shows up in the New York Times is an indication it's not a lawful whistleblower.
No, I don't disagree with anything, Pat. I mean, from a government standpoint, from a prosecution standpoint, from a legal whistleblowing standpoint, one cannot be a legal whistleblower if they release classified information to unauthorized third parties, whether it's the media or anybody else. And I mean, that goes for because there are no protections within the law that allow for that type of disclosure because it's obviously an unauthorized leak. Now, it comes into play from a public standpoint where there's huge debates over obviously what or who constitutes a whistleblower. And under the law, it's someone generally who would reveal waste, fraud, abuse, misconduct, even gross mismanagement, and obviously unlawful activities of individuals or the government as a whole or an agency, whatever it might be. And as Pat mentioned, there are procedures set up for individuals to report that information. And it is unfortunate that at times people become discouraged by those procedures, even when they do follow them. And it differs greatly, I think, between national security whistleblowers, where I mostly work in that arena, and non-national security whistleblowers. But for example, you know, historically, Daniel Ellsberg's case comes to mind. His prosecution ended up being thrown out because the government committed its own misconduct by illegally raiding his psychiatrist's office. And then more recently, I think an example could be that of Thomas Drake, who was a former NSA employee who ended up pleading guilty to, I want to say, mishandling classified information or having some at his home. I'm blanking on the specific charge. Amidst a number of felony allegations. Now, Drake did first try to go through procedures. At least he tried to go through the Hill primarily. And there were other ways in which he could have tried. And that's some of the things that I do if someone comes to me, in hopefully before they've leaked classified information, because most people don't understand the wealth of range of information, of access, of attempted procedures that they can follow to try and bring to light problems within the classified arena. The bigger problem on these whistleblower cases that might end up then as a leak case is there is no such thing as a public interest defense. And this is what Snowden and his supporters are complaining of. They equate and decry that they can't or he can't obtain a fair trial. And the fair trial means basically, in their view, that he has to be acquitted, which, of course, is not what the definition of fair trial is. You can have a fair trial and be convicted. But they decry the fact that there's no public interest defense, meaning they can't say that as a matter of law, what he did, if he was a whistleblower, by the nature of the information being valuable to the public, in public interest, in exposing this, that, or the other thing, and you know, we can debate some of the information he did disclose, that he can't use that as a legal defense to say, look, I did this, I was justified in doing it, it was a good thing that I did it. Hey, even Eric Holder said it was in the public interest, at least part of what he leaked, and so he should be exonerated from any legal culpability. That doesn't exist. The only way in which someone can really convey the equivalent would be during sentencing. So you could say, hey, you know, he was convicted. Did he or she, doesn't matter who, you know, leak the classified information at trial or in a plea, decided that, you know, they did. And then during sentencing, you can show what was, getting back to what you said, Adam, motivation. You know, were you altruistic about doing this? That you wanted, there was a good reason and a good public reason for why you did it, and that might impact the sentence that the judge imposes.
And Adam, if I could just talk about the public interest defense idea, because
sure.
I think it's an interesting issue. I mean, from my perspective, I think, you know, prosecutors, they're obviously aware that there is no such thing as a public interest defense, but they're also have to be aware that you know, some judges would be very tempted by it under certain circumstances, and I think that has to be a consideration in the context of a prosecution. You know, you could imagine a case, and to my mind, you know, it would be a scenario where a person made you know, significant efforts to confidentially blow the whistle and was rebuffed for reasons that seemed, you know, poor in retrospect, that they were careful in the way they leaked. In other words, that they were sort of targeted in disclosing what they thought was the quote unquote bad thing without dumping the baby out as well. And you can imagine a set of circumstances where a person says, you know, look, it killed me to do this, but I couldn't think of any other way, and you know, this is where I was, and this is what I thought. And I think that even though that defense has never been recognized in the past, you know, as a prosecutor, you'd have to be aware that there's always a first sometime. I mean, we certainly saw how national security law changed and morphed in the stresses of 9/11 in terms of, you know, some of the activities that the government was involved in, and the court extending habeas to individuals that I think that, you know, hadn't received habeas before. And so the public interest defense, to my mind, is something that prosecutors need to be aware of as a theoretical issue, even though it's never been recognized by a court, and even though the government would fight like heck to make sure it doesn't get recognized in the future. You'd want to be wary of the set of circumstances that would make that appealing to a judge.
And there may be ways in which we could use under CIPA, the Classified Information Procedures Act, to try and effectively graymail, which is what CIPA was created to try and prevent. that could go into if there is a real legitimate sort of public interest in the information and what the underlying activities might have revealed through the disclosure. Of course, most of the prosecutions are brought in the Eastern District of Virginia, and I think the last case that I can recall in John Kiriakou was a former CIA case officer, actually was my client at one point. I represented a witness, one of the journalists, during his criminal case, actually. And the judge in the Eastern District, I think it was Judge Brinkema, expressly rejected the public interest defense. As much as I am, I guess, looked on as being on the defense side of things, or I'd say the one area that I really have a problem with is that you can't right now challenge the overclassification or improper classification of the information. I actually am one of the folks who do not support a public interest defense. I do not think it is manageable in the context of a jury deciding what is public interest by way of disclosing information. It's like, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I honestly don't think you could create a cognizable, recognizable standard that would be protective of national security.
Yeah, and the other thing I'd say, too, about that is that, like, you know, the Snowden case would be, in my mind, it would be particularly hard because of the volume of information that was disclosed and the way in which it was disclosed to conceive of a circumstance where a judge would be tempted by that, because, you know, obviously there's a lot there that you could point to say, look, this wasn't a careful move by somebody who was at the end of their rope in terms of trying to get somebody to address an issue of waste, fraud, abuse, or misconduct.
Well, I'll ask you a question to both of you that has a not so subtle assumption built in as to both of your points of view on it. I guess to Pat, if you see any shortcomings in the current whistleblower provisions or protections, do you think that it's procedural and how they're written, or is it more of a phenomenon of bureaucratic inertia and you know, just agency attitudes and how these things get processed? And likewise, Mark, I assume that you would like to see some changes or improvements in those procedures, and I'm wondering what you might suggest.
Well, let me address your question first, because that way give Mark an opportunity to really speak to this. I'm not an expert in the whistleblower laws. My sense is that you would really be swimming upstream because of bureaucratic inertia as much as anything else in terms of trying to get your agency to pay attention to your concerns, and that is probably a significant problem. I do think that some of the instances I've seen where people are whistleblowers, to some extent they suffer from not being in a position to sort of see a greater context and an appreciation of some of the other interests that are in play, and so it's hard for them from where they sit, and then of course no one ever takes the time to explain to them when they make their complaint kind of what has gone into this decision, and so they feel as if they've never gotten a fair hearing, and you know, I would concede that there probably are instances where that feeling is a legitimate one. But Mark's the one who knows how the statutes really work.
Yeah, there's no doubt, like with many statutes, there can be improvements, especially within the national security arena, where the process, maybe understandably, but obviously favors the U.S. government to prevent it. On paper, the procedures are very good for the most part. There is a ton of bureaucracy that comes into play. And, you know, the system is only as strong as sort of the weakest link. And if you have people who are part of the problem, who are then overseeing the process, that obviously raises questions into people's minds. And especially in the intelligence community, things are so compartmentalized, it raises a lot of questions when I have clients come to me and they only know part of the puzzle. and they reasonably and legitimately report on what they see, that something disturbs them, and they put it up the chain. And one of the biggest problems I see within the system is that there is no real mechanism for the government, whatever agency it is, to then get back to that person, that possible whistleblower. And most times people don't, they're not trying to be a whistleblower. They're just really trying to do their job and what they think is the right thing. They basically become forced into being a whistleblower. But nobody reports back to them to tell them, no, look, I totally understand what you're saying, but this is what you don't know. And part of that's because of the intelligence compartmentalization problem, where they may not have a need to know. The problem with that is that it spurs on that individual oftentimes to keep moving forward and even create a bigger problem because they might not have known the whole picture. One of the things I'd love to see, I also don't think there's enough education within the government as to how to be a lawful whistleblower, but one of the things I'd love to see is something of an outside body. It would be great if it could include people in the private sector, but even if it's other agencies who comprise a body that if a whistleblower, let's say at the CIA, came forward, that they could go to this outside body with comprised of other government agency personnel, senior personnel, who could evaluate what the claim is so that there is no bias that's coming from the agency. There's something that exists within the security classification system already called the ICECAP, Interagency Security Classification Appeals Panel. They oversee mandatory declassification requests. They're out of the Information Security Oversight Office within the National Archives, and the ICECAP is comprised of senior officials from different agencies, DOD, state, CIA has an ad hoc role, and Justice Department, if I said DOD, but they're on it too. And if there is a classified document that comes to them for review, they judge it, and it's not their equities. They can hear arguments from the agency whose equities it is, but the fact of the matter is something like more than two-thirds of the time, this body rejects the agency that has the ownership of the documents, arguments, and rules that the information should be declassified and revealed. And I think that's a great model that they could try and do for whistleblowers.
Well, thanks, guys. If we can back ourselves out of the whistleblowing for just a second, and let's assume back to our hypothetical that we've got a leak. Pat, what are some of the considerations that the government takes into account when deciding whether to pursue criminal charges? I know you've talked a little bit about this, but can you expand a bit?
Yeah. So the core challenge is, can you make progress in your investigation without having to seek any information from the news media that printed the classified information in the first place? And the reason for that is that the Justice Department has guidelines in place that essentially require the investigators to sort of exhaust all other available avenues of investigation before they worry about what records they could or information they could get from the reporter. And so you really need to be in a position where you've done a lot of work and you've gotten some traction. If you do a lot of work and you don't get any traction, then you're not going to go seeking the reporter's phone records or even seeking to question a reporter, because there's really no reason to think that it's going to be very fruitful. And there's sort of a limited number of opportunities, in my mind at least, from the DOJ's perspective. They don't want to go to that well too often, and it wouldn't be a very appealing case if there's no sort of sense of what happened. So what the FBI will typically do is try to identify the universe of individuals who had access to the information, and then there's a lot of shoe leather involved because they'll try to go interview everybody, and they will whether it's people on the Hill or employees of an agency, they'll just go and try to crank through the whole list of people and ask them questions. And they're government employees, they're it's very hard for them to say, well, I decline to speak to you. So they're going to be cooperative, and you know, they were in a position to ask them questions about, you know, who they communicated with and what they know about what was out there. And that process, you know, is really at the core of every one of these investigations. And again, we're not talking about the Snowden or Manning type cases, but that's the process they usually follow. Now, you know, there's instances where that gets shortcut. I mean, this woman, Reality Winner, that was recently charged, and this is just based on news reports. I mean, they in that case, the FBI and the agencies involved were able to sort of quickly determine through digital footprints who exactly had accessed the document and downloaded it, and they were able to isolate on her very quickly. And that may more and more be the case, that kind of work will shorten these investigations. But basically, most of what goes into these investigations is FBI questioning people and, you know, getting a foothold in somebody who either acknowledges speaking to the reporter but denies talking about this, or somebody who might even concede saying certain things but not other things. And then you're on the road to saying, okay, that's our number one suspect. Let's see what we can do to try to, you know, determine whether or not they actually leaked the information.
You had mentioned, you know, government employees specifically. Is there any difference between a USG employee who's a suspect versus a contractor?
No, not really. I mean, the government contractors are going to have the same. They're certainly going to be concerned that their employees are cooperative. So it's not as if the government contractor will typically, you know, advise its employees that they should do anything other than assist in the investigation. So generally, it's not the case that the contractors are really any different.
Now, Mark,
go ahead. I was just going to follow up on what Pat's talking about on this digital footprint, in fact. So, I mean, I've been representing individuals who were either suspected of leaking or alleged to have leaked for over 20 years. And I differ from many of my colleagues on this notion that there's been a war against whistleblowers. I think there's a war against leakers, and I don't know why there wouldn't be within the U.S. government, although it's certainly sort of arbitrary and a little bit selective, because many leaks come out of Congress, many leaks come out of a White House, regardless of whose it is, for political purposes, and they're never prosecuted, and everybody could figure out why that is. But really what has changed, and you hear this notion of the Obama administration prosecuted more classified leakers than any administration preceding it combined. Yes, statistically that's true. But if you look at the majority of the cases, they were all pretty much to a T, all happened because of digital and technological capabilities of the U.S. government to finally obtain evidence. These digital footprints, people were using email and cell phones and variety of other methods that communication methods that were being traced and tracked by the U.S. government. Many times because the tradecraft of either the reporters or the leaker or both were frankly quite poor. And then they were able to be caught. If we go by what has been said about Reality Winner in the press, that was frankly a really easy case for the FBI to identify who she was. Only a small handful, I think six people, had printed the specific document that she allegedly leaked to The Intercept, and she had communications on her personal email system, which she had used on a government computer, so they had tracked that, emails with The Intercept, and I probably would imagine she was the only one out of the six people who printed the document. So, you know, real easy case. Now they're into legal issues about, you know, whether she was Mirandized properly and things like that. But those are very separate issues. But the biggest problem for leakers, and I'm certainly not advocating classified leaking. I'm against classified leaking. But the biggest problem is, you know, they need to do a better job of figuring out how to access the info. You know, and from a digital, from a physical security standpoint, the U.S. government's been lacking. I mean, that's how Manning was able to download 750,000 documents or pages, and how Snowden was able to retrieve up to 1.7 million pages through systems that, frankly, they shouldn't have been able to.
The other thing, that Mark's comments make me think about is it sort of demonstrates the tedious nature of these cases. Part of the reason the Obama administration got, you know, labeled as being so vigorous in enforcement of leak investigations is that a couple of cases that had been investigated for years finally came ripe when the Obama administration took office. So in other words, these are cases that were initiated during the Bush administration. And number one, it takes a long time to isolate the leaker because you're, you know, as I said, you're going through and talking to different people who had access to the information and trying to mark them off the list. And then if you have the additional element of needing to seek testimony or records from a reporter, that's a very slow process because it requires, approval by the attorney general, which is something that takes a while to get. And, there might be negotiations with the media in between. And all that takes a long time. And at least a couple of those cases that earned the Obama administration those labels were cases that had been initiated years before, and it was simply the case that it took that long for them to become public matters because these cases take so long to bring forward.
In fact, there's one specific example, the prosecution of Jeffrey Sterling, who was a former CIA case officer, which was one of my cases. That criminal investigation started at least in 2003 when I was meeting with the FBI as they were interviewing my client. But it didn't come to head into a prosecution until the Obama years.
Well, thank you guys. We've got just under 20 minutes left. There's certainly a lot more that we can talk about, more questions that I have. But Laura, let's open it up to the floor to see if anybody else has any questions and wants to chime in.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, Chris Garvey here. It seems to me that a lot of the whistleblowing cases involve things which are classified simply because the government wants to hide them, not because they should be hidden. And maybe we need a change in the law to make the public interest defense stronger. Is the person who's trying to raise a public interest defense prevented from presenting this in court?
Go ahead.
Okay. So, yes, they have tried to raise it. John Kiriakou was the last one, I believe, at least that I can recall, where actually had it litigated. And it has been completely shut down. And this goes to what I was talking about before, that where I do think there should be a role for a defendant to challenge would be to the classification, the proper classification of the information. In fact, in the Drake, in the APAC case, American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, where two of their employees were prosecuted for leaking classified information, the only time the Espionage Act has been used against people who had no lawful obligation to protect the information, meaning they had no security clearances themselves, which is usually the case for either contractors or government employees. And I represented one of the witnesses who was going to testify about the classification process. He was the former director of ISU, which is what I mentioned earlier, the entity in the National Archives. And he was going to say this information is not properly classified, was not classified, should not be classified. And as part of that, in a much bigger problem that the government had, they ended up absolutely dropping the prosecution charges against both of those individuals.
And just to sort of kind of frame it the way it would potentially arise, I mean, the statutes require not that the information be classified, but that it be information relating to the national defense. And that is something that the government is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, like any other element of the offense. Now, the fact that something is classified carries a lot of the water for the government when they're trying to establish that something is relating to the national defense. The fact of it being classified is a significant piece of what they put forward. So I don't disagree with anything Mark said, but just in terms of it, the way it comes up because the government has to prove that element, and then the defense obviously attacks the proof on that element.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for Thursday, November 2nd at 2 p.m. That call is entitled The Role of Treasury in National Security Policy and will feature Ambassador Robert Kimmett, Senior International Counsel at the law firm of Wilmer Hale. I don't see any questions right now, Adam, so if you have anything else you'd like to ask our speakers, that'd
be great. I've got a few. Thank you, Laura. And I'll give a quick shout-out to Thursday's speaker. Don't miss it. Kimmett is wonderful and really knows his stuff. Mark, we touched on this, I guess, a couple times with respect to the public interest defense, and I imagine that it's getting much more difficult given the digital footprint issues that Pat has raised. But, you know, how – if you – can generalize it all, how do you go about defending a leak case?
Well, I mean, they are very difficult because typically there is a good amount of evidence that demonstrates from a technological standpoint of the connection between the leaker and the recipient or publisher if it went to the media. Many of those cases ended up being pled out. Jeff Sterling's case is probably one of the few, at least from the ones I can think of off the top of my head, where actually it went to a full trial and Jeff was convicted, honestly, on 9 counts, and I really do think on circumstantial evidence, but that's the system. It was a jury who decided it, but all the others pretty much plea out, so you're trying to just obviously work the best type of situation. And the biggest problem that oftentimes emerges is this sort of double standard. We've seen some really high profile leak cases in the last few years, not just by virtue of the number of documents by Manning and Snowden, but also with General Petraeus and General Kelly, of which general it was recently. Both of whom were prosecuted under the Espionage Act.
I think that was Cartwright.
Cartwright. Thank you. I knew I was missing it somehow. Both of whom were prosecuted under the Espionage Act for giving unauthorized access to others of classified information. And, you know, you could argue they got somewhat of a slap on the wrist, at least compared to others who went to jail for doing similar. John Kiriakou disclosed classified information that was never published. He disclosed it to journalists privately in emails for them to try and do further reporting, and he ended up sentenced to almost 3 years in prison, and some of which I think was served at a halfway house or in his own house under house arrest. But, you know, David Petraeus and Cartwright paid fines and got probation, and, you know, anyone who watches Sunday morning news, you know, sees that David Petraeus, frankly, hasn't suffered very much as a result of the stigma of the prosecution, which is, I guess, to his own credit. But, you know, the double standard is very difficult to defend. I find that as much harder cases. Now, I've had cases where people don't know about at all because most people don't learn about Espionage Act prosecutions because it's usually mishandling of classified information. They have it at home. It never got released to anybody, and for some reason the government decides to prosecute or make someone an example of.
Just to comment on Mark's point about, you know, the high-profile leaker, I do think that one of the things that in recent years, you know, the number of cases that have actually come through the system, you know, I do think to some extent it might be a function of how much information sharing there is now within the government that gives people at a lower level access to more and more newsworthy classified information, and that plus some other things that are, you know, sort of, I think everybody's got their different theories about why this may happen more often, but you know, I think that part of what, so it's sort of, there's all these cases coming forward with people who are, you know, at best mid-level employees of government agencies or government contractors. And I do think it's true that in years past, when there were virtually no leak prosecutions that were successful, there certainly were instances where leaks occurred, but they occurred from people who were at the very, very top of the U.S. government, whether they're, you know, somebody in the Congress or you know, the number 2-3 official at a government agency or that kind of thing, and those cases, you know, as Mark suggests, tend not to go forward for a lot of reasons, and I certainly remember when I first started to supervise these kinds of cases, sitting down with the prosecutors that have been doing them for 15 or 20 years, and them saying, you know, look, to some extent, there's some cynicism among the line prosecutors and the FBI agents about these cases, because more often than not, the people who are complaining about leaks in general are the same people that are leaking specifically. And so that has been a phenomenon in the past, and I'm sure it'll continue to be something that you know, we see in the future. But all of the information, all the classified information that's flowing through the government has, I think, been part of the reason why there's more cases that are now being made against people who are at a lower level.
Now, we hear the term these days, insider threat, an awful lot to describe potential leakers or even mishandling of classified information, in addition to your traditional you know, stereotypical espionage mole type situation. To conclude, if there are no other questions from callers, you know, I'd like to get both of your thoughts on how both the branding on insider threats, you know, and the approach to those persons has you know, helped to curb the problem at all, or you know, we're still seeing an awful lot of leaks despite the kind of internal government campaign against insider threats and leaking, and what needs to happen to shut this valve off.
You want to start, Pat?
Sure. I think, you know, so insider threat, to me, there's at least two elements of those programs. One is a technical element, you know, programs that are trying to identify anomalies in what people are doing and what they're downloading and what, you know, the volume and all those kinds of things. It seems to me that the technical measures, it's hard to find much objection to those. I mean, it could be that they, as long as the IG or whoever's investigating, you know, within an agency is being judicious in how they conduct investigations. In other words, that they, the mere fact of an electronic anomaly, that ought not to cause somebody to be, you know, suspended from work or anything like that. There needs to be some due regard to the fact that there's a lot of reasons why these things could occur. That part's, you know, other than that, I think there's really hard to object to. I think perhaps part of what you're referencing is the idea of making employees more sensitive to what their coworkers are up to. And, you know, I think in theory it sounds good. In practice, you can imagine that it might bring out the worst in some employees. I do think that, you know, within the classified community, the concept of need to know is an important one that should be reinforced. And so when people are become aware of their coworkers who seem to have interest in information beyond what they need to know, then there ought to be, you know, some attention paid to that. I don't think that these kinds of programs are going to stop leaks, but I do think that they will, you know, potentially discourage those who might think it's easy to leak, and that it won't be that there won't be any repercussions. I don't think it's going to stop them all, but I think there might be some people on the fence who you know, are discouraged from going down that road by these kinds of programs.
So insider threat is the new term, but it's by no means new. Anyone who remembers the history of the CIA and James Jesus Angleton as the head of counterintelligence, in this, particularly in the 50s and 60s, knows what an insider threat program was. The biggest problem with it, and I handle it all the time, you know, without even discussing is Snowden a whistleblower or not, were his releases good or not, I can tell you the reaction that has happened from the government, not just to his case, but also cases like Manning's, also cases that are not leak cases, but still insider threat cases, such as Aaron Alexis, the Navy Yard shooting, or the Fort Hood shooting as well. These have created a more organized insider threat program that has caused a lot of problems for individuals, innocent individuals. Now, we need to have a program, and on paper, most of it, frankly, makes a lot of sense. But the government, unfortunately, in my view, and I have not served in it, I've just dealt with it for 25 years, often takes a sledgehammer when you need a laser precision approach, because it doesn't know how to deal with the issue precisely. You know, another analogy, you know, you're fishing for tuna and you're catching all these dolphins with the net because it's so wide. So, you know, just as Pat's saying, you know, we're still not really stopping the leaks, but what I can tell you that I've seen inside the intelligence community is a lot of people who have fallen, I'll say, victim to the insider threat program because they've been identified as a possible threat because, for example, they had problems with their physiological responses on their polygraph reinvestigation, that they were inconclusive and the government doesn't know what to do about it. So they go into the insider threat office and they actually get – they can't – if they're a case officer at DIA or CIA, they can't get an overseas assignment, which is devastating to their career, and it's all because they're – perceived as a possible insider threat, and the government would rather err on the side of caution and say, and what I see, you know, we always have this saying in the criminal world about, you know, we'd rather have, you know, 10 guilty people go free than one innocent person be convicted. But it's really the reverse in sort of the civil community, national security community, where, again, my personal opinion, at least from experience, is, hey, you know, 99 innocent people will have their careers damaged in order to prevent the one horrible, understandably bad person from, you know, leaking classified information. And we could have a whole segment on whether that's fair or not. It's just kind of the perception of reality that I see within the intel agencies. But as with anything, it's striking a balance. And I think the other thing I would suggest, I rarely see Congress doing oversight hearings on the insider threat programs. I see very little oversight, so it's mostly the foxes guarding the hen house inside the agencies, and there is a understandable, legitimate bias. And I think for some of these, we need to take a step back and maybe get some folks who don't, again, have a stake in the equities of that particular agency to be able to judge certain cases, so that the people who are dedicated to the United States, as, you know, 99.9% of the people who work in the federal government are, that they can go on and continue to support the activities and the mission of their agency and the government as a whole.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Our hour is just about up. I think we might be getting saved by the bell in terms of getting into any discussion of polygraphs. But I think it's now about 1:58. Laura, if there's another question, then maybe we can squeeze it in. Otherwise, I kick it to you to wrap things up.
Great. Seeing no more questions, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.